This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Crypto Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. With us is Creighton Harrington.
Hello.
And when you do that under the, I add the music in later, you can't even hear you say hello. It makes me laugh every single week when I re-listen to the show. It's like, hey. Well, that's not going to edit out right. And Greg Lenz.
Hello, everyone.
This is a weird show. For the first time since we've been back, it's just three people.
It is.
So normally it's several others joining us. Yeah.
We had a purity purge.
Galt went Galt.
I don't know if he went, if Galt is the appropriate word for what he went.
With a U in it.
Yeah, no, that would work.
It's a native Galt, not a Randian Galt.
Galt went him.
And then we had Lynn on, and we had Peffers on, Dr. Peffers, or as one listener said, who's this Sergeant Peppers, kids? you know who we should have had on tonight?
Who?
Paul Gable.
We probably could have. I think he's enthusiastic about being on the show, but I can't tell.
I feel like Chris Spangle right now is rubbing in the person's face.
Yeah.
He hasn't been on.
I'm sorry. I'll stop trolling.
I don't even know the guy.
I think his Facebook page to get on the show, though, is up to like 11.35 likes.
Paul Gable and Travis Wyke started a Facebook page on, Facebook.
Yeah.
And their goal, I said, if they got 100 likes, then they could come on the We Are Libertarians podcast. And so they started a Facebook page.
That's a terrible idea. You should have said, if you can get us 100 more likes, you can come on.
Well, but how do I verify that? We grow at an infinite rate. So we grow by twos and twos of people a week. So
and then we drop by like 1,000 and then go slowly back up again.
So search for that. Don't like it. So
just laugh.
Leave a message, but don't like it.
You'll thank yourself later. Really.
Make an opposite page and like it.
No, we kid you, Paul Gable. So this week we have Greg and I have done some preparation. Creighton prepared by watching Team America, and we're going to talk a little bit about North Korea this week. I almost forgot. We had a hard time. Like, there's so much stuff in the news, but none of it interested us at all. I don't know about Creighton. Do you want to talk about guns again?
Filibuster didn't happen because they tried the new stupid kind. So
boring. Yeah. You want to talk about immigration, Greg?
No. I leave that up to our personal legal immigrant on the show, Joe Ruiz.
And what? Oh, the budget? Oh, gee, what are we going to do? Complain about how big the budget is again?
Yeah, no.
It's just sort of meh. So I guess we'll talk about the only two things that we can talk about. We'll surprise you with the other later. But first is our favorite little pudgy dictator in North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Go ahead, Creighton.
Sorry. I love how this guy is threatening to blow us up. And all we can do is just make fun of him like crazy.
He is meme gold. Just absolute gold.
It was funny.
No, there's no way he could be taken seriously, man.
Oh no.
He could have his hand on the button and say, if you laugh one more time, I'm gonna push it. I wouldn't be able to hold it back.
He's a mouth breather. He's always got his little jaw hanging open. He's just a mouth breather. He doesn't look intelligent.
You know what's funny is, instead of fighting them, I'd love to just have the Air Force drop a bunch of paper memes on their citizens of the one where he's going, can I eat this?
Is this cake?
You told me there was going to be yellow cake.
Is this cake? All right, I want this cake. Oh, or those are shoes.
There was another one of the world poking North Korea that said, come on, do something funny.
The one where they shrunk his eyes and nose and mouth down real small. And he's got like a really tiny face.
Maybe that would be the Obama doctrine. He would just meme the population so they don't even take their leaders seriously.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if all these people are making these memes to work in Obama's office, and that is his offensive.
Yes. It's the CIA.
To embarrass him out of like, oh, yes. Stop.
He's waging social media warfare.
There was a funny thing that I posted on my personal Facebook page that I found on Reddit, and it was World War One propaganda, and it was the posters of, you know, we want you and get involved, and then World War Two propaganda was Rosie the Riveter and get engaged and all that good stuff, and then World War Three, and it's just all the memes of Kim Jong-il. It's like modern propaganda is basically just mocking somebody.
So. He's so mockable.
Oh, he is.
He is. He's just this little cartoon character. Why are dictators... Dictators in this day and age have been relegated, except for Putin, have been relegated into, like, this cartoon character. Like, they're all Dr. Evil from Austin Powers.
Yeah. Mass media has totally sapped all dictators of their authority.
It's because it's hard to emulate, you know, the craziness of people like Hitler and Stalin. I mean, these guys were the dictators of old, and they were just like, they kind of set the bar for being a tyrant.
What are you saying? You admire them?
No. They're incredibly efficient at eliminating races.
I'm just saying, as far as like what a dick, like they're the standard of what a person is if they're a dictator. You put Kim Jong-un up to next to like a Hitler. Yeah, he's a cartoon character.
But really, I mean, Hitler, you look at it, it's like, oh, he was a painter, and he was a terrible painter. There's another man floating out. Hitler's sort of falling into, with our generation, for whatever reason, Hitler's sort of creeping into Kim Jong-un territory. It's like, are you admiring this painting? It's one of Hitler's paintings.
I wonder if that's George W. Bush's future. And 40 years from now, they'll be mocking his dog paintings.
I don't think they'll remember him.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, are we going to take this kid seriously?
No.
Okay.
You know, there is, though, one, it puts China in a tough place. I know you've read, you know, the historical nature of it is...
Sure.
The Korean Peninsula was split after World War II. The Soviet Union controlled North Korea. We aided South Korea in establishing democracy.
We did our stuff with South Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a tale of two sides. I mean, the Soviet Union, after Japan loses in World War II, the Soviet Union takes over the North, the U.S. takes over the South, and look at the reason they're targeting Austin is because there's a giant Samsung factory in Austin, Texas.
Yep.
And, you know, do you have a Samsung phone, don't you?
No, I have an HTC.
HTC, but they're, I've got a Samsung television right there. So you see the difference there. And in North Korea, Kim Jong-sung comes to power, and the reason he comes to power is he's this charismatic person. He's backed by the Soviets, and he creates a philosophy, and I forget what the term is. It starts with a J, where it's basically nationalistic pride. And the Korean Peninsula, for most of its existence, has been pushed around by various groups. You know, Japan had invaded it. And so Kim Jong-un comes into power, and he creates this philosophy based on the Koreans are the greatest race on the planet, especially the North Koreans, the South Koreans not as much. And it's that's what he said. That was a direct quote.
I just picture him giving like a speech in front of people.
He's like, listen here.
It's like he probably sounds like Cartman when he talks.
Listen here. North Korea, we're great. South Koreans, not as much.
Not so much.
Not so much.
And you're kind of like Canada.
I mean, they're there and they do stuff.
And so
you might be related to them like eight generations back.
He basically had the isolationist philosophy that we're going to take care of ourselves. We're not going to participate with the rest of the world.
We could starve our people just fine.
Well, yeah. Now he didn't. He had. I mean, he certainly was a totalitarian, and he was not the monster that Kim Jong-il was. Kim Jong-sung, the dad, was this charismatic person that listened to his advisors. He legitimately wanted to, make the isolationist model and the communist model work in North Korea. And, of course, that means eliminating anybody who disagrees with you.
Yep.
You know, but it is Kim Jong-il, when he takes over in the late 70s or early 70s, I forget now, who really becomes the barbarian. And the way that he gains control is by really pushing the limits.
Pushing the limits of the size of glasses you can wear.
he becomes, basically, he controls the country by threatening everyone to send them to prison camps, death camps.
I bet that made him Ronery.
Stop it.
Oh, so Ronery.
I'm like, here's this horrible human misery, and Creighton just follows it up with a South Park joke.
Hey, show some respect, Team America.
Team America. That was our prep talk for this week. I'll take North Korea. Greg, you take the MSNBC chick and the budget in case we talk about that.
Seriously.
Creighton, you watch Team America.
But seriously, you can't take anything these people do seriously. I don't know why. There's just something...
You do if you're North Korean. I mean,
it's because they don't even know anything. They didn't even know what a TV was till like 6 months ago.
Well, see, here's the thing about North Korea. It's the most closed-off society on the planet, and it's because they've had, since the 40s, this mindset that they are the master race, that everyone else is inferior, that they taint their society by opening their borders and sharing in trade of any kind. Yet they do have some trade with China. And, you know, as society has needed, when you have a closed society like that, to get stricter, Kim Jong-il put this pedal to the metal, essentially, with the death camps. And this little fat kid is continuing that and is accelerating it, probably, because he, you know, it's just like Conrad Hilton, you know, and then Conrad Hilton built it and founded it. Then the next guy, the son, he really built it into a global thing. And then Paris Hilton.
Yep. I want to check the bloodlines for purity in the case of the... Kim Jong variations.
Well, see, the thing is, as the society became more sparse and famine and other outcomes of a totalitarian society came about, that's when Kim Jong Il started to really increase his lavish lifestyle. Mm-hmm. He had 20,000 movies and VHS and DVDs.
One of which was Team America.
Yes. He had...
Is this how they see me?
Right. He liked it. Just like Hitler liked The Great Dictator by Chaplin, which if you've not seen The Great Dictator by Chaplin, see it. And he had 100 limousines that were imported. He was at one time the world's largest importer of Hennessy. So he lived a lavish lifestyle, and, you know, it's really a horrific society. I mean, even just a handful of people have ever escaped North Korea. Mm-hmm. If you go on Netflix, one of the documentaries that I recommend everybody watch is Kim Jong-il, something like that. Yeah, I mean,
that's racist.
Well, Kim Jong Il, I think is what it is.
Ill of the thriller, Kim Jong.
And they interview the handful of people that have ever escaped North Korea, and they explain what it's like inside the society. They show never before seen footage of all of the parades and the missile parades. I mean, it's really a fascinating look into a society that nobody ever really sees.
No, and they stress. It's funny, this will actually tie in later, but you don't have any loyalty to your parents. Like, they remove any association to family and tribe. So it is purely an association of loyalty to the state.
Could you stop that?
I think Heineken might be able to sponsor us now. That was perfect.
We're looking for sponsors, and all of a sudden, as I'm finishing up my point, and if you go to, well, probably somewhere in the video... At this point in the video.
Somewhere between the start and the finish.
In
the
image,
video.
You can see Creighton and his friend who is on Hangout goofing off with each other via camera. We don't have the USB hooked up, so
I'm just enjoying a finely brewed drink from Holland.
That's right. So holla back at us, Holland.
Absolutely.
So, let's talk about the implications of what's going on and what the libertarian response towards North Korea should be.
Exactly what we're doing, making the fun of them like crazy.
Well, we're not doing that. Our government is, as well as creating memes, they're sending ships across the sea over to North Korea. As we've been sitting here, I've been getting CNN messages. And some people in the government think that they might have nuclear weapons.
But as of right now, there is no hard evidence that they have any, right?
All right. So 2 hours ago, a congressman, North Korea may have nuclear weapons that can be...
What congressman?
I don't know. This is... I'm just reading the alerts. Congressman, North Korea may have nuclear weapons that can be delivered by ballistic missiles with low reliability. And 16 minutes ago, an administration official says, we do not believe North Korea has developed a nuclear warhead. So now you may be listening to this a week from now.
Or if it was anybody like Lindsey Graham, it was Justin Amash or something.
It was Justin Amash.
I don't trust it. Because, are you sure?
It was Justin Amash. What do you say now?
I don't believe you.
There's a scholar at University of California, Berkeley, and you know, typically not a war hawk institution. He was saying that he believes they do have nuclear capabilities, but they have no way of deploying it,
right?
Other than essentially driving it on a bus into South Korea and setting it off.
They essentially, and I would guess that they don't have the ability to put it into a warhead.
They can't,
and actually
they
shoot
don't
it
have
off.
Any resources to make these things, do they?
Oh, sure they do. Well, their biggest trade partner is China.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is like anything that they get, they got to get from another country, right?
Yeah. China really is the big factor here. And just so everybody's clear, we're recording this Thursday evening on April 11th. So if you're listening to this...
So Judgment Day hits between now and then.
So if you're listening to this and you're listening to it inside of a nuclear bunker because North Korea really could shoot off, we apologize. And if that happened, this was an unfortunate joke.
We went out laughing.
Right.
And it's interesting, though, because what you think is just this... crazy failed state that no one should pay attention to. All they do is act like a petulant child in order to get attention, to get resources. But even China, who, you know, they supported them during the Korean War. That was their trade partner that helped finance their role in the war. China's even saying we're tired of it.
China at this point is drawing a line in the sand. And the majority of their editorials, I mean, China is not known for its open society. A lot of their newspapers are saying, we need to do something about North Korea. And their government officials, for the first time, really kind of ever, are coming out and saying, stop it. You're basically doing this for personal gain. You're throwing the world into a tailspin. And they do this all the time. And they do it because they want cash.
Yep.
They come out and they threaten war. And they go into these talks after they get their, you know, they go into talks after they've thrown their tantrum, and then everybody gives them cash to get them to be quiet. It's gone on forever. And I think the thing that worries everyone now is not that they have nuclear weapons. They certainly do have some nuclear material of some kind. It's that we don't know what this little fat kid is going to do.
Yeah.
We don't know if he's serious. We don't know if he's... actually dangerous? Is he going to try and avenge his father Monday?
Avenge his father for what?
Avenge his father.
Avenge my father who died sipping Hennessy in a comfortable bed.
I promise you, that kid sits there and he thinks that this little fat kid sits there and he thinks America killed my father. Because what?
Damn you, Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
Yeah.
Because what they have done, you're really just playing for an audience of one now, aren't you?
No.
You two are having a good time. I wish we could.
Because we're the ones that understand that Kim Jong Un is just the kid that got that on it. Like I said in the chat, I honestly think he's the guy who, like the Professor Chaos character, who puts on the aluminum helmet, sits at the table, says, "I'll get him," and plans this devious overthrow that's going to get foiled by his own inadequacy at being human. That's really how the guy presents himself.
In North Korea, the thing is that listen, you're poor and hungry because the West has done this to you. And they make it's a victimhood society, and I'm sure in somewhere his father was killed not of old age but of, you know, arsenic from Barack Obama or something.
Arsenic.
It'd be tied to Bush for sure. Had to be Bush.
It's always Bush's fault, isn't it?
No matter what happens, it's Bush's fault.
Even when dictators die, it's Bush's fault.
Oh, absolutely.
So
it's those bug drones that go in and give people heart attacks through their stingers.
So China is drawing a line in the sand. China is really, you know, there's two ways to look at it. There is the diplomatic way where they say, all right, we need to stabilize the region. We need to do what's right here. We need to settle these kids down. They're the grown-ups in the region that can get them on track. Or there is the conspiratorial view, which I will now give to you. Which is that China may use this as an opportunity to further devalue the American currency by involving them into a war. China recently has been making a lot of deals with Australia, Russia, India, all the BRIC countries, essentially. Brazil, Russia, India, and China being part of the BRIC countries. They've been stepping aside from the American currency and starting to trade with countries like Australia and Russia in their own currencies and going around the American currency. And they, some conspiratorial-minded people think that this might be a chance for there to be a war, get the Americans involved in another war, and fight America by proxy. Do you give that any credence, Greg Lenz?
I do not. I mean, I understand the idea, though, of trying to get America, like the U.S. dollar not being the world reserve currency anymore, and I think that can make sense from a Chinese perspective, but I don't think that's how they would go about it. Really, it goes back to their cultural ties in the 70s during the Korean War. And then also, by being the world's only ally, essentially, to North Korea, and North Korea being, I guess, a former ornament of the Soviet Union and their way to establish dominance, it's got like historical, I guess, prestige to it. Yeah. That's why they're attached to it.
It's really prestigious.
Well, I know, but I mean,
it's like keeping a 1974 Dodge Dart. This is my prized possession.
Yeah, and it would, if they decided to end, you know, ally status with North Korea, you would be in effect acknowledging communism is no longer a part of your ideology, your state ideology, and that poses problems.
What would you do in this situation if you were president? Would you go on television and openly mock the little fat kid?
Oh, yes. no, I'd probably... I mean, to be fair, you can't take a nuclear threat lightly, I guess.
he says grudgingly.
Even if it's from this guy... So what you'll probably do is set up a defense system of sorts. And, I mean, you don't just go straight in and invade the country.
Right.
You'll probably set up a defense system in an allied country. Rely on intelligence. I mean, if you're feeling moxie, you can throw in some CIA agents.
If you're feeling fancy, throw some CIA agents.
Throw some CIA agents in there.
Part of the problem is that it's so close that they can't find any CIA agents. They have no real intelligence. And the bulk of intelligence that, as I kind of poked around on the internet today, that I could find, it was from 1994.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the majority of the information, so it's not very reliable. I'd hate to say that I think Barack Obama is doing the right thing by moving us into a position where where we can protect ourselves, because I think you're right. I look at it and I go, okay, we don't know what they're going to do. They say they're going to bomb Guam and our U.S. interest in Guam and Japan. They might have nuclear capabilities. We have the ability to move ships and defense systems into the region to protect ourselves. We know they're not reliable. You know, it's like a bottle rocket, trying to shoot a bottle rocket straight. Good luck with that. So why not move things into position to protect ourselves, to make sure that they don't do anything rash? Does that sound unreasonable from a libertarian perspective?
No, it doesn't, but what it ignores is South Korea. Like, that's what has been driving me crazy, is no one's taken South Korea's perspective on this.
Mm-hmm.
South Korea is a free, democratic state. They're a first-world country. They have incredible commerce and government systems in place.
Galt would say they make the best phones.
He would, absolutely. But this challenge is... How many times do they have to sit there and take it? Because we tell them, no, come on, we'll get it worked out. They get constantly provoked by North Korea. They have had attacks on their own soil that they haven't been able to retaliate against. If I was a South Korean citizen, I would be appalled that people would tell me to just sit by and take it. You know, I feel like it's like when Israel gets hit by missiles.
Yeah, but when you rely on another country to provide your defense for you, then you kind of have to.
You do.
I mean, if I'm a South Korean citizen, I would be for independence. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, the Americans could leave. The Americans could say, I'm sorry, we can't afford another war. You're on your own. So why not, you know, this is part of the problem that as we expand our empire, one of the reasons that we have the North Korea, the seeds of the North Korean conflict have grown, is because we fought a proxy war of America versus the USSR in the Korean War in the 50s, and also before that, because we manipulated the area for interest and gain. I mean, at what point are we going to learn our lesson and say, you know, I mean, pragmatically, I get it. Okay, you can't just pull out and say we're leaving all of our troops, we're pulling all 30,000 of our troops out of South Korea today.
Mm-hmm.
Because that leaves an entire population vulnerable. But we can't stay in 170 countries forever. We can't be the policemen of the world. Because it means that people don't respect us over time. They resent our presence in their countries. And at some point, they need to defend themselves.
They do. They have the responsibility. Every state has the responsibility of defending itself. But in my opinion, and this is where it helps not being bound by, for me personally, the NAP, how we handle this is going to say a lot about how much we value democracy versus essentially negotiating with a terrorist state.
Okay, I thought you were going to continue with your point. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I think it says a lot about our role or what we believe by not standing there and saying, no, you guys need to stand up. We'll sell you the arms. We'll structure arms agreements with you. If you guys want to go after them, we'll be behind you, but we are not going to put American lives at stake.
Right. I mean, Creighton, in this situation, what do Americans do? Do we pull our troops out? Do we do it gradually over time? I mean,
pull our troops out of South Korea?
South Korea.
I mean, I would be down for that regardless of the situation with North Korea. I think South Korea, they have the necessary resources to take care of themselves. I mean,
we're talking about a population of 50 million people, roughly, in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It's a prosperous nation.
Extremely.
And then in North Korea, you have 30,000 people, and they're poverty-stricken.
Yep.
And hungry. I mean, I don't understand why they couldn't build up their own army to protect themselves. And legitimately, they do. I mean, it's not like they're just total freeloaders. They do have a military.
Yeah, they have institutions in place. But North Korea's mental makeup is very warmongering. They're very militaristic. I believe they have 800,000 in military forces, not including their elite military forces.
Sure.
So that's what makes it so difficult to say. You have South Korea, who I would guess doesn't have more than 100,000. That's
right.
What I would guess. And so they're completely outmatched. And then on top of North Korea constantly threatening that they have nuclear capabilities, which they probably don't have good systems in place, that there could be a nuclear meltdown at any time.
Right.
Yeah. Why would you march in there and try to overthrow them? But they do have, you can stay isolated or try to isolate yourself from North Korea, even though you're on the same peninsula, while being aggressive at the border and saying there's certain things we won't tolerate ever.
Sure. So I think let's take a show vote. Pull out of South Korea completely tomorrow like a bunch of wacko birds, or continue to support the military lane until this passes?
We can give them a week.
Okay. Greg?
I would actually stay there and support them, and I would force China's hand. I would structure an arms agreement with South Korea where they would pay us a private fee in order to supply them with the weapons they need. And that would drive China crazy, because then there would be another militarized area there. But China has to pick a side. They either have to pick, they're going to stick with their allies and North Koreans, or they are going to assume world leader status and control how they react.
All right. Well, Greg Lentz for president, everybody. Creighton, any final thoughts on North Korea?
We need to make a Team America, too.
I think it's time. I mean, this little fat kid's face is just so perfect. I mean, it really is just, it's like a dream come true.
I hope James Cameron uses him in Avatar 2.
I hope there isn't a nuclear war, because people will listen to this like 3 weeks from now and be like, God, those a-holes. Like, there's no more North Korea or South Korea. Listen to these heartless bastards. So as of the time of this recording, nothing bad has happened, and everybody is mostly safe. So,
how do you think it ends, ultimately?
I think that this is just another one of the long little tantrums that this country has He is trying to solidify the forces in the country. In North Korea, there are three leaders. There's the head of state, there is the head of the parliament, and then there's the head of the military. And Kim Jong-il and now Kim Jong-un have been the head of the military. And they are, for all intents and purposes, the bosses of the of North Korea. So he is trying to get the military to rally around him by creating confidence in his abilities as a leader, as a militaristic leader. You know, he's propagandizing the crap out of it to make sure that people feel the love for Kim Jong-un. And if you watch the National Geographic documentary with Lisa Ling on Netflix, you know, they talk about Kim Jong-il and they all start crying because they're just so amazed. Like she goes in with this eye doctor who's fixing cataracts, and they're so ecstatic because now they can actually see Kim Jong-il.
Yeah.
Because he is the one that gives them life.
He's godlike status.
Right. And so it's important for Kim Jong-un to make sure that he has that same status as his grandfather and father. And so he's saber-rattling. He may launch some missiles, but I don't think the missiles are reliable at all. And to the rest of the world, if the missiles fall in the middle of the ocean and, you know, if they even don't get off the ground, if they don't launch, North Korean media will, you know, it's a great success. We have hit Guam. You know, they'll spin it any way they can, and people will believe it because the great dear leader said so. So I think it's a PR opportunity more than anything for Kim Jong-un. I think, you know, China will assert itself over him, and it may be a sign that there are instabilities within North Korea that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
That he feels like he needs to act in this way, it could indicate that maybe he doesn't have the power base secure,
yeah,
like his father. So it's really interesting to see what happens. I mean, I think moving our defense systems into place, I think that is perfectly acceptable from a libertarian standpoint. You know, we're non-interventionists. I would never support us invading Korea or doing anything that would be aggressive towards them. But I do think that you should protect yourself because you can't not take the threat seriously, you know. But we have also put ourselves in a position where we have to act on a country that's thousands of miles away because we make ourselves the world's policemen. So
we do.
We'll see.
How does the NAP, when aggressive is forced upon you, what are the stipulations around coming back, like issuing a response?
I mean, Creighton, with the NAP, if some country attacks us or is aggressive towards us, what do we do?
Blow them.
Because that's the way I feel.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
if they do hit Guam...
It's not pacifist.
We're not pacifist.
No, I know that, yeah. But I didn't know if you were still bound to only self-defense to a point where you were secure, or if you could, like, in my opinion, if they hit Guam, I would black out the sky with the Air Force and bomb it. I think
that's a potato-potato, or not a potato. I think that's one where somebody who is really against fighting would probably say, no, we can inflict violence upon them if we feel a threat is imminent. Mm-hmm. Me, if you punch me in the face, I'm going to kick you in the balls and rip your heart out.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
That's where I stand.
I would say that with North Korea, if it were China, you'd have to prepare an all-scale war. I mean, same with Russia. With North Korea, if North Korea were to attack Guam, I mean, you have selective bombings. You decapitate that society and ensure that they are, you know, that the government that exists now no longer exists.
Yeah.
But you do everything you possibly can do to ensure that the poor people of that country are have no more damage inflicted on them. One of the reasons I think China will make sure that this thing stays stable is that they don't want the massive humanitarian. I mean, here's a society that has been, since 1948, has been brainwashed and starved and has not been taught any kind of I mean, as much as they like to say, oh, well, we're self-sustaining, they're not.
No.
And they don't know how to produce goods. They don't know how to, you know, as a society, they will be one of the poorest countries for hundreds of years. I mean, just because they have been set back so far, which is why the next topic here in a minute is so shocking. But, you know, here's the deal. When you have a society that is as punished, you wanted to go out of your way to make sure that you don't inflict any more damage, but you ensure that that government that's making that decision, that's creating the threat, is destroyed. You know, so.
But at what point are you, even though you've been brainwashed, and I understand the effects of that are incredible, and maybe reason can't even sink in when you're in that closed of a society. But there has to be a certain point where a group takes responsibility and changes things. Do you not agree with that?
But you've got, like, I think it is so ingrained in that society, the love of the government, the fear of the government.
See, I think it's more fear.
Touches every, I think it's a mix. And I think you've got every single person in that country, all 30-some million people, are so incredibly terrified of going to a death camp and are so downtrodden and just trying to survive to the point that whole swaths of land have no bark on the trees because people have eaten the bark off the trees. You can't really mount a revolution in a country like that successfully. They're unarmed. They have monitors every square inch of that country for people who love the government. And then you've got people who are unwilling to stand up and fight for themselves. So
because they can't just have no idea of what their society's like, because you have South Korea literally right next to you, who is free and democratic.
Oh, you have society. You have, they keep people, I mean, they have towns. You see South Korea and it's, you know, populated and buzzing, and they built this 300-foot flagpole with the South Korean flag, and you go across the river, across the DMZ, North Korea erected this dream town in 1950, and it's abandoned, and they did it because they wanted South Koreans who were in this poor village across the river to defect over to the North Korean side, and they built a 500-foot you know, they can't feed their people, but they're building 500-foot flagpoles.
I'm just amazed there hasn't been one small band of individuals, and maybe there has because I'm not that sure, familiar, that hasn't posed a resistance ever.
I just don't think that they know. I mean, and maybe they do in the outer bands of the country where they can get Voice of America and, you know, the propagandized, but I don't know. So we'll see. I just don't see how it ends. You know,
makes me question whether reason and freedom can be logically deduced then.
I don't know. Yeah. It's a deep thought, Greg. So, all right, let's move on to the end from the end of the end. We're moving on to the Predator. Let's move on from the end result of a certain line of thinking, and let's hear the start of a certain line of thinking.
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have, because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody's responsibility and not just the households, then we start making better investments.
All right, so after that was airing and going viral this past weekend, guess what the first segment on the Glenn Beck Show was about? So you have this woman. Do you guys even know who this woman is?
Yes.
This is a promo.
Yes.
Who was on MSNBC, and she's apparently an MSNBC host. Who is she, Creighton?
She's Melissa Harris Perry. She's a teacher, I think, at Princeton.
She did teach there.
She did teach there until, yeah, MSNBC probably pays her more.
And she taught at University of Chicago too. I think that's where she met President
Well,
Obama.
What I've experienced from seeing her talk on TV is everything is about race.
Yeah.
Period. Oh, you don't like wearing blue jeans? You're a racist. Oh, you think cheese pizza's good? You're a racist. It's like, oh, you don't think pepperoni's good? Well, you're a racist too. Racist, 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 racist. She's one of those people. Everything in our society revolves around race to this lady. I mean, it's really just the way she died. Just that's how I've experienced it. And it's like, if there's nothing to talk about, well, let's talk about race. Oh, how do we get in a post-racial society when all I can do is talk about race?
Yeah.
You know?
She wants it in the forefront.
She's one of those. She's like Touré. Touré. However you say that guy's
yeah,
name.
Oh, yeah. Touré from MTV or whatever.
Whatever. However you say that guy's name. Everything to this lady is about race. It's really unbelievable. I've watched her show a couple times, and it's pretty impressive how she can bring some of the most random. It's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. How can you get this to be about race?
Right. People like to wear white on Labor Day.
No, oh, it's racist. No, that's how I've experienced her. So it does not surprise me at all that she's one of those kind of people. You know,
you don't own anything.
Right.
The community is important. God, hail the community.
So, wow. That was an impressive voice. So maybe her experience is that if you own property, that's just another tool of the man trying to keep the...
No, it's another tool of the white man
the
trying
white
to keep
man
you down.
Trying to keep the black man
just
down.
Remember, it's all race. It's all I've ever heard her talk about.
I don't want to be one of those people where I talk about race because I'm not a racial... I get sick and tired of hearing all these fat old white conservatives sit around and talk about, you know, well, we got a black president. What the man name? I mean, there's still injustice in the world. There's still racist.
So then I guess I'll just
like
talk
that.
Right here.
Well, listen.
Who have you been listening to? And they're like, well, I was a black president.
Strom Thurmond just showed up in the...
Hey, if you tune into WIBC in the mid-afternoons, you'll hear it then.
It's like a Howard Cosell had a stroke and just came on our TV show.
I swear to God, that black president, he goes on so many black vacations.
Black
How many
president.
More vacations is that black guy going to go on? He needs to work harder.
He likes to go golfing.
I mean, you can't deny that there is, among the conservatives especially, it's just like they're like the opposite version of this MSNBC lady. Everything is about race with them. There's, you know, we can't let the immigrants in. We got to kill the Muslims. You know, it's just, you can't deny that's, yeah, it's xenophobic. I mean, I've been in church groups where the conversation is, I mean, it really is scary that the Caucasians are going to be a minority in the next 10 years. And I'm sitting there going like, what the man of church am I going to?
Oh,
you know,
man.
And it's so, you can't deny that it's out there, but you
it's
know,
the Rick Santorum
it's a good thing
wing.
I'm Irish.
Yeah, Irish. I know. I've never oppressed anyone. I'm German. So. Wait. Moving on.
Yeah, that went weird. For
where's Joe? Where's Joe? And
we'll
cut
that one out.
Yeah. So, how did we get here?
Race.
All
Creighton.
Of a sudden, we're
blame
like
it all on Creighton,
making fun of Imus and.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
I wanted to talk about this because I don't know who this person is. I don't know anything about her. I don't care that she tries to make everything about race. That's her gig. Whatever. I don't have to listen to you. I don't care about race because at the end of the day, you know, the millennial generation especially, I just really don't care what your race is or what your orientation is or anything like that. I really just care if you're a nice person and if you work hard. And, you know, if you want to achieve...
It is.
Sorry, what'd you say, Creighton?
That's racist.
Oh, yeah.
She would say, because you're indifferent, that means you don't have the same levels of passion towards them
sure.
of hatred and love.
Well, there was the Purdue... Did you guys see that there was a big hubbub? And I turned into that Imus old white fat conservative complaining about white racists. This past week, because here in Indiana, we're in Indiana, we have Purdue University. It's an engineering school, and some engineering nerds got together and decided to do a video about the engineering department, and they did a Carly Rae Jepsen thing, and it wasn't that creative or anything, but it was good. It was interesting. Mitch Daniels was in it, and the anti-racism group at Purdue University wrote a letter demanding that that be pulled. That be taken down because it did not reflect diversity, and it showed that all engineers at Purdue were white males.
And which couldn't be further from the truth.
Right. I mean, there is a large amount of diversity, and they're not reflecting the diversity that is entailed in the Purdue engineering department. It was written by a white guy, like some old white guy the 1960s liberal professor, the Ward Churchill of Purdue, who was complaining about how Mitch Daniels was somehow tied to the teacher strike in Chicago. It's like, you know, trying to connect the dots. So it's just tired. You know, it's not.
I'm so tired of race being talked about.
I know.
That's what kind of infuriates me about this girl is she the way she speaks of it, you think that she believes she's still in the 60s. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of these people don't seem to realize that while we aren't a post-racial society, like we'll ever be that ever, like anybody can ever be post anything. It's like, we'll be a post-private property society. We'll be a post Nazi society. I mean, there's still Nazi groups in the United States. Yeah. There's still every type of group that we've not wanted to be associated with ever in the United States. So there's always going to be a racist. They're always going to, you're never going to get beyond that. But to say that we are still in, like, you know, hosing down groups of black people with fire hydrant hoses and throwing dogs on them, that doesn't happen anymore. That stuff happened, and it doesn't happen anymore. Yet to them, you would think that we still live in that kind of
Selma
society.
Was yesterday to her.
I mean, it's like, give me a break. I mean, we have advanced so far beyond this, and you're not willing to give it any credence because somebody said something that's at one point in time may have been a racial slur about somebody somewhere.
This lady does not. I mean, she's trying to earn a buck. I mean, she's trying to be the next Jesse Jackson. She may believe it. Otherwise,
Well, she better start talking like Jesse Jackson.
Yeah. Andy Grove, the former CEO, I believe it was Intel, used to have a great line about Jesse Jackson, and I think it applies to her. It was, he referred to Jesse Jackson as a seagull because he'd fly into town, crap all over everything, and then fly back out. And I thought, that is exactly what this woman is. And she makes the case that communities raise, engage your community to raise a child. And I say, all right, I'll take you on a walking tour of every urban school district in America, and you show me how much that community cares about that school.
Right. Well, that was a real old white man conservative thing to
because,
say,
it's because it probably was, we don't give them enough money, man. The community isn't caring enough.
I prepared for that argument.
They haven't cared enough, man. They just, it's not that they should care. It's that they don't care enough.
Yeah.
They only spend 80% of all tax revenue on the schools, not 85.
I was adjusting the gain if you heard flapping around, because sometimes Creighton likes to talk like this, and then other times Creighton likes to talk like this. Real loud than the
sometimes microphone. I have trouble controlling the volume of my voice.
Loud noises. So here's the question that I really have struggled with as I've heard this. We live in a society where you have a woman who is on one of the big three cable television networks, who's clearly got one of the coveted spots of the liberal media, where not all of media, but the liberal media, you know, there's The Nation, there's The National Review, there's MSNBC, Slate, you know, it's a nice spot for a liberal commentator. How do we as a society have someone who says that your children do not belong to you, they belong to the collective? And then on the other channel, you've got on The Blaze, you've got somebody like Glenn Beck who's like, you know, children are completely your property and the community has no say over them whatsoever. You know, and those are two media representations of where we're at in this country. You've got one extreme who says that we have to completely get rid of property almost at the foundational level, you know, and then on the other side that everything is property and everything is property rights and everything is individual rights and we help our community, but we're not compelled to or forced to. I mean, these are two fundamental differences, and I don't know how we as an American political system can work together when you have two belief systems that are so opposed to each other. And these are not the wing nuts. I would say that as a libertarian who tries not to be a wing nut, I look at what she says and what'd you say?
And fails.
Oh, how dare you, sir? I try not.
Because you're Canadian.
Oh, you son of a. So I'm a smart man. I try to be. Try to be well-read for the most part. And I try not to engage in insane conspiracy theories or anything like that. I find her view absolutely abhorrent, and I am the complete opposite. She's probably a very smart person. She teaches at Princeton. I certainly don't. But she's obviously thought
out. It's because you're racist.
That's true.
you can teach at Princeton.
So here's the question to you. Let's go to you, Greg Lins, first. How do these two sides, who have wildly different foundations, find common ground and work together in the modern American political system? Go.
Thankfully, the answer lies in the founding of our country, in that we have a federalist system.
Going with the race. See, listen.
Man.
Yeah, they're racists. Yes. But they also designed a federalist system where they gave certain rights to the federal government that were supposed to be, in theory, limited.
Did you hear that, Creighton? States' rights. Yeah. You know what that means? Code.
Yep. If you even
say
the 10th Amendment by name, you're a racist.
What are you gonna
racist?
Go,
that's the litmus test.
What are you, John C. Calhoun or something?
Yeah.
What are you going to go speak at Howard?
Yeah, what's the matter with you? Racist?
Oh, my. I advocated war, and now I'm being portrayed as a racist.
That's true.
You know what, though? The sad thing is like we joke and whatnot, but it's just that's the state of, you know, race dialogue in America.
It's absurd.
It really is. It's reached the level where if the word racism has been so broadly defined that it has no meaning anymore.
Mm-mm.
And it's kind of unfortunate because there is like a legitimate history that the African American community can identify itself with, and significant, you know, things that it has surmounted and things that they have moved beyond, and significant figures that are respectable. Like Martin Luther King is a respectable figure.
He's one of my heroes.
He advocated for good things, and he stood for good things. And a lot of that has been sullied because people have gotten kind of drunk on the sympathy, I think, to an extent. And that's some of it is they're just, it's just, it kind of, when so you go through something like that, I'm sure it kind of consumes your perspective on the world. And I think that a lot of what I've experienced is it's so consumed the perspective on the world that everything is viewed through that lens, and it's hard to not see everything as being about race when for so long everything was about race.
Who?
That was your entire worldview.
By whom do you mean they?
Oh, yes. Now I'm the racist.
Right.
See, there's a culture of fear around being called a racist. And
sure.
There should not be. There should not be, because if I treat everyone the same, regardless.
Right.
And I hold everyone to that same standard, I should not be a racist.
And the sad thing is it doesn't even, actions don't even matter when it comes to it. You could have done, as you're a politician, you could have dropped, you know, thousands of dollars on, millions of dollars on various, you know, minority-related programs. I mean, you could have volunteered time at homeless shelters that dedicate themselves to minorities. It doesn't matter what you do. The minute you come out and you say colored, or something, you're racist, and you're never going to be able to grow past it, period.
Wow,
no matter what you do.
Yeah.
That just got real weird, Greg.
Well, I'm serious.
Did the guy in the Bass Pro Shot hat just say colored
yeah,
on the podcast?
It takes that sentiment of not being afraid, and I am not going to be afraid of the racist police that try to govern all of media.
Honestly, if somebody's going to be an a-hole, if they're going to be so bigoted that they're racist, I would rather have all these people wear it on their sleeve because I know not to associate with them at that point.
By the way, Greg, Racist Police, my favorite 70s cop show.
Really?
I loved watching that on TV Land as a kid.
Was that TJ Hooker?
Racist Police.
There are two things, though, that are really concerning. Is this lady, I don't know her full name, I'm sorry, I apologize.
Melissa Harris Perry. Sharp.
She wasn't a part of the civil rights movement. She is one generation removed from the people who are engaged in it.
She looks to be about 40-ish.
Mm-hmm. And I would think by now that they would see there have been improvements made and that there would be a little bit more of a moderation towards just calling everyone a racist as soon as you say even... She's the kind of person that when Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the Democrat, revered Democrat from New York, liberal Democrat... He was a sociologist. He published a report called the Moynihan Report that showed what the effect the welfare state had on the African-American families. Essentially, they went from 85% of African-American couples married in Harlem And over the course of 30 years, it went down to 39%.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, there's obviously always going to be work on people's attitudes. I mean, we should celebrate how far we've come. We should celebrate the fact that we have an African-American president. We don't have to celebrate the policies. We obviously disagree with almost everything he does as libertarians. But the fact that we have an African-American president, a black president, is incredible. You know, and I
completely
think
completely self-made. Completely.
Yeah, right. I mean, despite what Glenn Beck says, here's a guy who comes from a home that is, I mean, he comes from a broken home,
mm-hmm.
and he put himself through school. His wife put herself through school, and you know, it's an incredible story. You know, there is an. I posted the picture of Bill Clinton on my Facebook wall. And it's a picture that I got off Reddit, and it has Bill Clinton with two shirtless black teenage boys. I don't know what was going on.
I think, actually, I'd looked into it. I think it was he visited the Louisville locker room.
Yeah, after their Elite Eight win. Yeah.
All right, so after they won, he went into the Louisville room, and I'm just like, why is Bill Clinton in a photo with two shirtless young men? And I posted it up on my wall, and I wrote caption contest. And every white person then proceeded to caption it with, like, something about weed or something about rap
music.
That's
not a racist joke. They're just making fun of basketball players.
And I'm like, come on now. Come on. And I wrote, like, there were a few cigar jokes. And then, like, I finally wrote, like, maybe this was a church social, you racists.
Yeah.
And, like, it got a couple likes, but it's kind of true. It's like you're sitting here saying, oh, well, you must be smoking weed and listening to rap music with black teenagers. So.
I know, that was really weird. The meme turned from being about Clinton to being about Clinton's environment, and I was kind of stunned because most of your friends are all libertarians. I was like, huh, I might as well just go back to the Republicans.
So I do think that there is a little bit of like, hey, we don't even look at something like that, and when we go to make a joke, it's sort of like the same thought process as, you know, I've got a black friend. Well, why has your friend got to be black? Why isn't he just your friend? So, you know, we still all,
I think when people emphasize that, when somebody makes the point to point out that the color, they identify someone based upon the color of their skin, that isn't in and of itself, I think, bad. It's like saying that you identify someone by their red hair is bad. I think when it becomes an issue is when people think that it is such a bad thing that you've identified them by the color of their skin. They're another person just like you. Like, well, yeah, I mean, I don't really care. The color of their skin doesn't matter as far as what I think, like their worth as a person. It's just an attribute. And I think we're at the point in America where if you're a white guy and you point out the color of somebody's skin and they're a black guy, that is in and of itself considered racist.
I mean, if I couldn't make fun of gingers, I'd lose half my material.
And Canadians.
Right. Well, listen, they're the only race that you can discriminate against.
And it's not even making fun of people. It's like,
I've got the solution.
Do you feel comfortable saying black people as opposed to African American people?
I personally don't really have a problem with it. And I haven't experienced anyone who's had a problem with it. I mean, I have black friends, and they have never...
Oh, that old gag.
Yeah.
Pull that card out. Yeah, my best friend's black.
No, they're not... I mean, I have friends that are black. They're not, like, my bros.
Oh, wow. You're digging a hole,
see,
man.
You can't say anything without me taking the wrong way.
There's a way out of this, though. Every time you introduce someone, you introduce them first by name, and then you give three choices. This is my friend Creighton. He's either white, black, or Asian. And that way, your bases are covered. You are putting the choice of racism on the other party.
Wait. I might be all three of those.
Yes.
All right, let's answer the original question. Somehow we started talking about... Somehow the guy in the Bass Pro Shop turned
that
into
is
race.
That is the power of her... personality, that anytime you talk about her, it starts to devolve about race.
Creighton, here's the question. How can we in the American political system find common ground or work together or have these grand bargains when you've got two sides who are so far apart in their foundational ideology?
Well, I think for the most part, now this lady is probably not going to be this answer won't work. I think what she was hearkening to, I think, or at least what her audience hears, they may not hear what we heard. We heard somebody saying that your child is not, you don't have control over your child's destiny, I guess, your child's future. other people whom you don't know, whom you aren't associated with, have a right to tell your child what to do, even if you don't think that they should. That's what we heard. What I think her audience hears is we need to have a culture change where people want to invest more money in the education of children. That's what her audience heard. So I think as far as building common ground with people like that is, how do you better educate children? And I think we would argue that throwing more money after, you know, the massive increase in funding that we've given public schools since the 70s and before that even, you know, think there's a good enough empirical evidence to say, I think, that test scores are not related to the amount of money given to a school.
There is overwhelming amount of evidence that shows that. So I did some
How does somebody like that? I mean, she doesn't get that. She's not listening to your statistics and proof and science.
Well, mm-hmm. The thing is like if you've ever watched Thank You for Smoking, you're never going to convince the person you're arguing with, only the people that are watching. So I think what has to be done is you have to find a way to say, well, we too agree that children need to be educated, that they are not being adequately educated, that there is a need for children because it's our job as to give our children a better future and blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. We want to do that through this. This does not require more money from people going after the same old that hasn't worked for decades. This is what we're saying. So I think you can reach her audience at least through means like that. Now, for the people who do hear it and they say, yeah, because we're all in this together, no one has the right to say that they can't, that they shouldn't have to have responsibility with this and their children they have the only ones that claim to their kids because blah, 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 blah. Those people are just, you're never going to win them. But I think they're enough of a minority to not really matter.
You know what? I say turn it around on them. Like, okay, we're going to try it your way. We're going to make every parent sign a contract that they are going to agree to certain stipulations for their child's educational achievement. And if they don't, then they do not care about the community and they should be ostracized by the collective.
No, I think then their children should be taken from them because they're not helping with their
You want to go education? Down that route? We're never going to win saying, hey, here you go. Here's a voucher.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I think we should just speed up the entire communistic statism. What the hell are you talking about?
No, I'm saying, okay, here's the thing.
You know what? Instead of fighting their ideology and discussing this rationally, let's just give them what they want and help them and speed it up.
No, because the
majority... Some just want to watch the world burn. Right.
No, the majority are rational. They will get they get the sentiment that we got to raise this child as a community. But when you start putting that pen to paper in actual terms they have to live up to, they will revolt and want to go a different direction.
Yeah, when you tell a parent that...
I mean, every kid.
It's when you tell a parent that they do not have... Not that, you know, your child doesn't get to have these opportunities. It's one thing to say that we're not going to offer this opportunity to your child. It's another to say we're literally going to take your child, your free will to an extent with your child. We are going to tell you that your child is literally not your child to an extent because of our new culture that we're trying to push. That's going to have a totally different reaction because you're straight up telling a family you belong to the state.
Yeah, I think
you belong to the state.
I think the idea of saying, well, parents need less responsibility and the school and the community needs more responsibility. I think most teachers, anyone who's listening as a teacher, is going, that's the worst idea ever. Because any teacher you ever talk to says, you know what, these kids would succeed and my job would be easier and their grade test scores would be better if parents were more involved. If parents asked at the end of the day, not how was your day at school, but what did you learn? What homework do you have? And if you're listening and you do that, you're a good parent. And yep. If you ask, just say, how was your day? They go, fine. They shuffle after their... I mean, get involved. Ask. You should know your teachers by your kids' teachers by their first name. I think teachers would appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, talk to the principal and get that teacher fired.
Absolutely. You can't do that, teachers' unions. But I tell you the truth. What this really is we're upset with this, but this is really the ultimate end of... a philosophy that, or at least of the philosophy of the welfare state. I mean, when you start with the premise that the society has the obligation to help those who do not have the means to help themselves, which may be noble and may be true, but maybe not best be done through the government. When you have that philosophy that people who are down in the dumps, they need help from the general public, you know, the logic drives you to, well, how do we prevent these people from ever getting there in the first place? Normally, it has always been, we need to educate them. We need to make them be better educated. Well, if you take that even a step further, then a child who is not being educated is a future welfare recipient, and therefore it is the responsibility of the public to make sure that that kid is better educated. So all she's really doing is taking the logic of the welfare state and just taking it a few steps back and saying, you know, we all, if we don't educate this kid, then we're going to have to pay for him. So, mm-hmm. You know, we need to stop having this idea that your child is your own, because if you're not doing good, then we ought to do something for you. I mean, we ought to go in there and we ought to try and fix it up a little bit. You know, you're not doing a good job. And
he's got a weird accent.
That, it's supposed to be a mob accent.
Yeah, he went a little Italian.
Forget about it. Forget about it.
But honestly, that's the truth. I mean, when you have this mentality that the public owes everybody who had the misfortune of being alive something, then it naturally just gets to the point, well, how do we prevent this something from happening? And then you start invading on people's rights as parents, rights as people, rights to property. You start invading on all this because, well, we're just trying to prevent bad things from happening. I mean, it's just the logical extension of the welfare state.
Go ahead, Greg.
And those two things are interrelated. Her obsession with race and then this community involvement in raising of the children. Somewhere along the line, the narrative changed from equality of opportunity to equality of ends and essentially scholarships, affirmative action.
Right. Not now, everyone should have the same outcome. Not everyone should have the same beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the three different kinds of equality. And somewhere along the line, equality went from, hey, we're not stopping you, to you get this. This is your entitlement, and spend it however you like.
Sure. We got to wrap up, but I would say that I'm going to end with kind of, I'm going to tie it in a little bit. I had a conversation this week. Somebody was bitching about how the Libertarian Party isn't 10th Amendment-y enough. And I just said, you know what? What are you doing? Why aren't you involved in your local party? For one, the LPIN is having a 10th Amendment speaker at their convention. And two, if you're not in Indiana, write an article for the website. Start a 10th Amendment group and get libertarians involved in it. Why are you sitting here complaining about how the Libertarian Party is not doing something that you care about and you're just no better than any liberal? You're sitting here complaining about what somebody is not doing instead of saying, how can I help make this so? And it's that same mentality. I think the majority of success is just showing up. And I think far too many people in society, probably 80 to 85% of people, just don't show up. They just kind of go along to get along, let life happen to them, complain about life happening to them.
Have you taken a youth leadership school?
No. Why? Yeah. Is that where we retrain the youth?
Because you drop YLS quotes a lot.
Do I?
You drop Leadership Institute quotes a lot.
No, I've just actually led libertarians for roughly the last 5 years.
80% of success is showing up. I've heard that at so many LI trainings.
But it's true.
It's true, but it's just funny.
I mean,
Woody Allen said it. Of course it's true.
If you, well, there's a lot of things he said. But the bottom line is, if you don't want the community to raise your children, raise your own damn children. If you want some group that you associate with to do something different, then do it. You own a political party. You are the political party. You are this. You are that. I mean, join the community and actually get off your ass and do something.
If you want responsibility, then freaking take it.
So, I'm sorry. I just got a little pissed off last night as I was reading. I was like, what don't you understand? I was flipping my table and bashing my keyboard and ranting. So, mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention that on the podcast.
No, it needs to be said. It absolutely needs to
be said.
I mean,
bottom line
stop
is...
stop being a keyboard activist and go out there and do stuff.
No, but it's... even if it's just writing an article, even if it's just, you know, don't sit there and complain about what other libertarians or what other Republicans or what other Democrats or what other people are not doing because you have the view that this is the way that it ought to be, but I want other people to execute my ideas for
me. Well, they would just get involved if it was like that, man.
Right.
Like, I mean, I would be more involved with the LP if they would just talk about the 10th Amendment more.
It's like, get involved. Get into the fight. It's not even a fight. It's just that there's no one involved that is doing that and saying that. you bastard.
And the next step of that, though, is...
It's okay.
We just lost a listener, I think.
is getting beyond the minority mindset of the Libertarian Party, where you can just take shots at both sides without having to actually present your side of the argument and entering the
ideas.
It's
not even just about the Libertarian Party.
No, it's just society.
It just pisses me off about 80% of people. Quit complaining about your problems and do something about it. All right, Greg, wrap up this week. What else is coming up this week or anything that we might have missed?
Watch North Korea closely, because we're either going to be total a-holes or we're going to call it right, maybe.
Creighton?
Are you okay over there?
I'm fine.
I swear I saw a Grind My Gears thing come up here, and Peter Griffin sitting next to me.
You know what grinds my gears? Seriously, I'm having a Grind My Gears moment.
My advice to everyone, watch Team America a few times. Go write hate mail to Melissa Harris Perry, just because I'm not a big fan of saying, you know, writing people mail, because she's not going to read it. But just do it anyway.
Right.
Just blow their servers
up. It'll make you feel better.
Let's be fair. She isn't one of those people that goes out and just says, racist, racist, racist. What she is she's the kind of person that says, this is about race, this is about race, this is about race, this is about race. So I guess it's a very fine line. She isn't out there saying everybody's a racist. What you can kind of just smell it, that everything's about race because everyone's a racist. You know, that's kind of how it is. So,
all right, let's wrap up.
Okay, but yeah, watch Team America a few times. Go hate on Melissa Harris Perry. Mad Men started again.
Mad Men. Man. We haven't even gotten
time to
that.
Do the Mad Men podcast.
You
know what John Hamm would say to all these race baiters?
What?
The universe is indifferent.
That's right.
That's exactly what he would say. And then he'd have a cigarette and drink some bourbon.
It is.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening. You are the best. If you want to do something, go to WeareLibertarians.com. Go to the submissions page. Learn how you can write articles for Weird Libertarians or do something else. I don't know. All right. Thanks for joining us. As always, we'll do better next week. Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell. This podcast is produced by What Is a Hoosier Productions.